embroidery, of which the colors and figures are the manners of men. And there are many who, like women and children, prefer this variety to real beauty and excellence. The state is not one, but many, like a bazaar at which you can buy anything. The great charm is that you may do as you like. You may govern if you like. Let it alone if you like. Go to war and make peace if you feel disposed, and all quite irrespective of anybody else. When you condemn men to death, they remain alive all the same. A gentleman is desired to go into exile, and he stalks about the streets like a hero, and nobody sees him or cares for him. Observe, too, how grandly democracy sets her foot upon all our fine theories of education. How little she cares for the training of her statesmen. The only qualification which she demands is the profession of patriotism. Such is democracy. A pleasing, lawless, various sort of government, distributing equality to equals and unequals alike. Let us now inspect the individual Democrat, and first, as in the case of the state, we will trace his antecedents. He is the son of a miserly oligarch, and has been taught by him to restrain the love of unnecessary pleasures. Perhaps I ought to explain this latter term. Necessary pleasures are those which are good, and which we cannot do without. Unnecessary pleasures are those which do no good, and of which the desire might be eradicated by early training. For example, the pleasures of eating and drinking are necessary and healthy, up to a certain point. Beyond that point, they are alike hurtful to body and mind, and the excess may be avoided. When in excess, they may be rightly called expensive pleasures, in opposition to the useful ones. And the drone, as we have called him, is the slave of these unnecessary pleasures and desires, whereas the miserly oligarch is subject only to the necessary. The oligarch changes into the Democrat in the following manner. The youth who has had a miserly bringing up gets a taste of the drone's honey. He meets with wild companions who introduce him to every new pleasure. As in the state, so in the individual. There are allies on both sides, temptations from without and passions from within. There is reason also and external influences of parents and friends in alliance with the oligarchical principle, and the two factions are in violent conflict with one another. Sometimes the party of order prevails, but then again new desires and new disorders arise, and the whole mob of passions gets possession of the Acropolis, that is to say, the soul, which they find void and unguarded by true words and works. Falsehoods and illusions ascend to take their place. The prodigal goes back into the country of the Lotophagi or drones, and openly dwells there. And if any offer of alliance or parley of individual elders comes from home, the false spirits shut the gates of the castle and permit no one to enter. There is a battle, and they gain the victory, and straightway making alliance with the desires, they banish modesty, which they call folly, and send temperance over the border. When the house has been swept and garnished, they dress up the exiled vices, and crowning them with garlands, bring them back under new names. Insolence they call good breeding, anarchy, freedom, waste, magnificence, impudence, courage. Such is the process by which the youth pass from the necessary pleasures to the unnecessary. After a while he divides his time impartially between them, and perhaps when he gets older and the violence of passion has abated, he restores some of the exiles and lives in a sort of equilibrium, indulging first one pleasure and then another. And if reason comes and tells him that some pleasures are good and honorable and others bad and vile, he shakes his head and says that he can make no distinction between them. Thus he lives in the fancy of the hour. Sometimes he takes to drink, and then he turns abstainer. He practices in the gymnasium or he does nothing at all. Then again he would be a philosopher or a politician. Or again, he would be a warrior or a man of business. He is everything by starts and nothing long. There remains still the finest and fairest of all men in all states, tyranny and the tyrant. Tyranny springs from democracy much as democracy springs from oligarchy. Both arise from excess, the one from excess of wealth, the other from excess of freedom. The great natural good of life, says the Democrat, is freedom. And this exclusive love of freedom and regardlessness of everything else is the cause of the change from democracy to tyranny. The state demands the strong wine of freedom, and unless her rulers give her a plentiful draft, punishes and insults them. Equality and fraternity of governors and governed is the approved principle. Anarchy is the law, not of the state only, but of private houses, and extends even to the animals. Father and son, citizen and foreigner, teacher and pupil, old and young, are all on a level. Fathers and teachers fear their sons and pupils, and the wisdom of the young man is a match for the elder. And the old imitate the jaunty manners of the young because they are afraid of being thought morose. Slaves are on a level with their masters and mistresses, and there is no difference between men and women. Nay, the very animals in a democratic state have a freedom which is unknown in other places. The she-dogs are as good as their she-mistresses, and horses and asses march along with dignity and run their noses against anybody who comes in their way. That has often been my experience. At last the citizens become so sensitive that they cannot endure the yoke of laws, written or unwritten. They would have no man call himself their master. Such is the glorious beginning of things out of which tyranny springs. Glorious indeed, but what is to follow? The ruin of oligarchy is the ruin of democracy, for there is a law of contraries. The excess of freedom passes into the excess of slavery, and the greater the freedom, the greater the slavery. You will remember that in the oligarchy were found two classes, rogues and paupers, whom we compare to drones with and without stings. These two classes are to the state what phlegm and bile are to the human body, and the state physician or legislator must get rid of them, just as the bee master keeps the drones out of the hive. Now, in a democracy, too, there are drones, but they are more numerous and more dangerous than in the oligarchy. There they are inert and unpracticed. Here they are full of life and animation, and the keener sort speak and act, while the others buzz about the bima and prevent their opponents from being heard. And there is another class in democratic states, of respectable, thriving individuals who can be squeezed when the drones have need of their possessions. There is, moreover, a third class who are the laborers and the artisans, and they make up the mass of the people. When the people meet, they are omnipotent, but they cannot be brought together unless they are attracted by a little honey, and the rich are made to supply the honey, of which the demagogues keep the greater part themselves, giving a taste only to the mob. Their victims attempt to resist. They are driven mad by the stings of the drones, and so become downright oligarchs in self-defense. Then follow informations and convictions for treason. The people have some protector whom they nurse into greatness, and from this root the tree of tyranny springs. The nature of the change is indicated in the old fable of the temple of Zeus Lysias, which tells how he who tastes human flesh mixed up with the flesh of other victims will turn into a wolf. Even so, the protector, who tastes human blood, and slays some and exiles others with or without law, who hints at abolition of debts and division of lands, must either perish or become a wolf, that is, a tyrant. Perhaps he is driven out, but he soon comes back from exile, and then, if his enemies cannot get rid of him by lawful means, they plot his assassination. Thereupon the friend of the people makes his well-known request to them for a bodyguard, which they readily grant, thinking only of his danger and not of their own. Now let the rich man make to himself wings, for he will never run away again if he does not do so then. And the great protector, having crushed all his rivals, stands proudly erect in the chariot of state, a full-blown tyrant. Let us inquire into the nature of his happiness. In the early days of his tyranny, he smiles and beams upon everybody. He is not a dominus. No, not he. He has only come to put an end to debt and the monopoly of land. Having got rid of foreign enemies, he makes himself necessary to the state by always going to war. He is thus enabled to depress the poor by heavy taxes, and so keep them at work. And he can get rid of bolder spirits by handing them over to the enemy. Then comes unpopularity. Some of his old associates have the courage to oppose him. The consequence is that he has to make a purgation of the state, but unlike the physician who purges away the bad, he must get rid of the high-spirited, the wise, and the wealthy, for he has no choice between death and a life of shame and dishonor. And the more hated he is, the more he will require trusty guards. But how will he obtain them? They will come flocking like birds, for pay. Will he not rather obtain them on the spot? He will take the slaves from their owners and make them his bodyguard. These are his trusted friends who admire and look up to him. Are not the tragic poets wise who magnify and exalt the tyrant and say that he is wise by association with the wise? And are not their praises of tyranny alone a sufficient reason why we should exclude them from our state? They may go to other cities and gather the mob about them with fine words, and change commonwealths into tyrannies and democracies, receiving honors and rewards for their services. But the higher they and their friends ascend Constitution Hill, the more their honor will fail and become too asthmatic to mount. To return to the tyrant. How will he support that rare army of his? First, by robbing the temples of their treasures, which will enable him to lighten the taxes. Then he will take all his father's property and spend it on his companions, male or female. Now his father is the Demas, and if the Demas gets angry and says that a great hulking son ought not to be a burden on his parents and bids him and his riotous crew be gone, then will the parent know what a monster he has been nurturing, and that the son whom he would fain expel is too strong for him. You do not mean to say that he will beat his father? Yes, he will, after having taken away his arms. Then he is a parricide, and a cruel, unnatural son. And the people have jumped from the fear of slavery into slavery, out of the smoke into the fire. Thus liberty, when out of all order and reason, passes into the worst form of servitude. In the previous books, Plato has described the ideal state. Now he returns to the perverted or declining forms, on which he had lightly touched at the end of Book 4. These he describes in a succession of parallels between the individuals and the states, tracing the origin of either in the state or individual which has preceded them. He begins by asking the point at which he digressed, and is thus led shortly to recapitulate the substance of the three former books, which also contain a parallel of the philosopher and the state. Of the first decline he gives no intelligible account. He would not have liked to admit the most probable causes of the fall of his ideal state, which to us would appear to be the impracticability of communism or the natural antagonism of the ruling and subject classes. He throws a veil of mystery over the origin of the decline, which he attributes to ignorance of the law of population. Of this law, the famous geometrical figure or number is the expression. Like the ancients in general, he had no idea of the gradual perfectibility of man or of the education of the human race. His ideal was not to be attained in the course of ages, but was to spring in full armor from the head of the legislator. When good laws had been given, he thought only of the manner in which they were likely to be corrupted, or of how they might be filled up in detail or restored in accordance with their original spirit. He appears not to have reflected upon the full meaning of his own words. In the brief space of human life, nothing great can be accomplished, or again, as he afterwards says in the Laws, infinite time is the maker of cities. The order of constitutions which is adopted by him represents an order of thought rather than a succession of time, and may be considered as the first attempt to frame a philosophy of history. The first of these declining states is timocracy, or the government of soldiers and lovers of honor, which answers to the Spartan state. This is a government of force, in which education is not inspired by the muses, but imposed by the law, and in which all the finer elements of organization have disappeared. The philosopher himself has lost the love of truth, and the soldier, who is of simpler and honester nature, rules in his stead. The individual who answers to timocracy has some noticeable qualities. He is described as ill-educated, but, like the Spartan, a lover of literature. And although he is a harsh master to his servants, he has no natural superiority over them. His character is based upon a reaction against the circumstances of his father, who in a troubled city has retired from politics, and his mother, who is dissatisfied at her own position, is always urging him towards the life of political ambition. Such a character may have had this origin, and indeed Livy attributes the Licinian laws to a feminine jealousy of a similar kind. But there is obviously no connection between the manner in which the democratic state springs out of the ideal and the mere accident by which the democratic man is the son of a retired statesman. The two next stages in the decline of constitutions have even less historical foundation. For there is no trace in Greek history of a polity like the Spartan or Cretan passing into an oligarchy of wealth, or of the oligarchy of wealth passing into a democracy. The order of history appears to be different. First, in the Homeric times, there is the royal or patriarchal form of government, which a century or two later was succeeded by an oligarchy of birth rather than of wealth, and in which wealth was only the accident of the hereditary possession of land and power. Sometimes this oligarchical government gave way to a government based upon a qualification of property, which, according to Aristotle's mode of using words, would have been called a timocracy. And this in some cities, as at Athens, became the conducting medium to democracy. But such was not the necessary order of succession in states. Nor, indeed, can any order be discerned in the endless fluctuation of Greek history, like the tides in the Euripus, except, perhaps, in the almost uniform tendency from monarchy to aristocracy in the earliest times. At first sight, there appears to be a similar inversion in the last step of the Platonic succession. For tyranny, instead of being the natural end of democracy, in early Greek history appears rather as a stage leading to democracy. The reign of Pisistratus and his sons is an episode which comes between the legislation of Solon and the constitution of Cleisthenes. And some secret cause common to them all seems to have led the greater part of Hellas at her first appearance in the dawn of history, for example, Athens, Argos, Corinth, Sicyon, and nearly every state with the exception of Sparta, through a similar stage of tyranny which ended either in oligarchy or democracy. But then we must remember that Plato is describing, rather, the contemporary governments of the Sicilian states, which alternated between democracy and tyranny, than the ancient history of Athens or Corinth. The portrait of the tyrant himself is just such as the later Greek delighted to draw of Phalaris and Dionysius, in which, as the lives of medieval saints or mythic heroes, the conduct and actions of one were attributed to another in order to fill up the outline. There was no enormity which the Greek was not today to believe of them. The tyrant was the negation of government and law. His assassination was glorious. There was no crime, however unnatural, which might not with probability be attributed to him. In this, Plato was only following the common thought of his countrymen, which he embellished and exaggerated with all the power of his genius. There is no need to suppose that he drew from life, or that his knowledge of tyrants is derived from a personal acquaintance with Dionysius. The manner in which he speaks of them would rather tend to render doubtful his ever having consorted with them, or entertained the schemes, which are attributed to him in the epistles, of regenerating Sicily by their help. Plato, in a hyperbolical and seriocomic vein, exaggerates the follies of democracy, which he also sees reflected in social life. To him, democracy is a state of individualism or dissolution, in which everyone is doing what is right in his own eyes. Of a people animated by a common spirit of liberty, rising as one man to repel the Persian host, which is the leading idea of democracy in Herodotus and Thucydides, he never seems to think. But if he is not a believer in liberty, still less is he a lover of tyranny. His deeper and more serious condemnation is reserved for the tyrant, who is the ideal of wickedness and also of weakness, and who in his utter helplessness and suspiciousness is leading an almost impossible existence, without that remnant of good which, in Plato's opinion, was required to give power to evil. Book 1. This ideal of wickedness living in helpless misery is the reverse of that other portrait of perfect injustice ruling in happiness and splendor, which first of all Thrasymachus, and afterwards the son of Ariston, had drawn, and is also the reverse of the king whose rule of life is the good of his subjects. Each of these governments and individuals has a corresponding ethical gradation. The ideal state is under the rule of reason, not extinguishing but harmonizing the passions and training them in virtue. In the democracy and the democratic man, the constitution, whether of the state or of the individual, is based first upon courage and secondly upon the love of honor. This latter virtue, which is hardly to be esteemed a virtue, has superseded all the rest. In the second stage of decline, the virtues have altogether disappeared, and the love of gain has succeeded to them. In the third stage, or democracy, the various passions are allowed to have free play, and the virtues and vices are impartially cultivated. But this freedom, which leads to many curious extravagances of character, is in reality only a state of weakness and dissipation. At last, one monster passion takes possession of the whole nature of man. This is tyranny. In all of them, excess, the excess first of wealth and then of freedom, is the element of decay. The eighth book of the Republic abounds in pictures of life and fanciful illusions. The use of metaphorical language is carried to a greater extent than anywhere else in Plato. We may remark, 1. The description of the two nations in one, which become more and more divided in the Greek republics as in feudal times, and perhaps also in our own. 2. The notion of democracy expressed in a sort of Pythagorean formula as equality among unequals. 3. The free and easy ways of men and animals, which are characteristic of liberty, as foreign mercenaries and universal mistrust are of the tyrant. 4. The proposal that mere debts should not be recoverable by law is a speculation which has often been entertained by reformers of the law in modern times, and is in harmony with the tendencies of modern legislation. Debt and land were the two great difficulties of the ancient lawgiver. In modern times, we may be said to have almost, if not quite, solved the first of these difficulties, but hardly the second. Still more remarkable are the corresponding portraits of individuals. There is the family picture of the father and mother and the old servant of the timocratical man, and the outward respectability and inherent meanness of the oligarchical, the uncontrolled license and freedom of the democrat, in which the young Alcibiades seems to be depicted, doing right or wrong as he pleases, and who at last, like the prodigal, goes into a far country. Note here the play of language by which the democratic man is himself represented under the image of a state having a citadel and receiving embassies. And there is the wild beast nature, which breaks loose in his successor. The hit about the tyrant being a parricide, the representation of the tyrant's life as an obscene dream, the rhetorical surprise of a more miserable than the most miserable of men in Book 9. The hint to the poets that if they are the friends of tyrants, there is no place for them in a constitutional state, and that they are too clever not to see the propriety of their own expulsion. The continuous image of the drones, who are of two kinds, swelling at last into the monster drone having wings, Book 9, are among Plato's happiest touches. There remains to be considered the great difficulty of this book of the Republic, the so-called number of the state. This is a puzzle almost as great as the number of the beast in the Book of Revelation, and though apparently known to Aristotle, is referred to by Cicero as a proverb of obscurity, Epistolarum ad Atticum. And some have imagined that there is no answer to the puzzle, and that Plato has been practicing upon his readers. But such a deception as this is inconsistent with the manner in which Aristotle speaks of the number, Politics, and would have been ridiculous to any reader of the Republic who was acquainted with Greek mathematics. As little reason is there for supposing that Plato intentionally used obscure expressions. The obscurity arises from our want of familiarity with the subject. On the other hand, Plato himself indicates that he is not altogether serious, and in describing his number as a solemn jest of the Muses, he appears to imply some degree of satire on the symbolical use of number. Compare Cratylus, Protagoras. Our hope of understanding the passage depends principally on an accurate study of the words themselves. on which a faint light is thrown by the parallel passage in the ninth book. Another help is the allusion in Aristotle, who makes the important remark that the latter part of the passage, Greek, describes a solid figure. Politics. He only says that nothing is abiding, but that all things change in a certain cycle, and that the origin of the change is a base of numbers which are in the ratio of 4 to 3. And this, when combined with the figure of 5, gives 2 harmonies. He means when the number of this figure becomes solid. Some further clue may be gathered from the appearance of the Pythagorean triangle, which is denoted by the numbers 3, 4, 5, and in which, as in every right-angled triangle, the squares of the 2 lesser sides equal the square of the hypotenuse, 9 plus 16 equals 25. Plato begins by speaking of a perfect or cyclical number, Timaeus. That is, a number in which the sum of the divisors equals the whole. This is the divine or perfect number in which all lesser cycles or revolutions are complete. He also speaks of a human or imperfect number, having 4 terms and 3 intervals of numbers, which are related to one another in certain proportions. These he converts into figures, and finds in them, when they have been raised to the 3rd power, certain elements of number, which give 2 harmonies, the one square, the other oblong. But he does not say that the square number answers to the divine, or the oblong number to the human cycle, nor is any intimation given that the 1st or divine number represents the period of the world, the 2nd the period of the state, or of the human race, as Zeller supposes. Nor is the divine number afterwards mentioned, Aristotle. The 2nd is the number of generations or births, and presides over them in the same mysterious manner in which the stars preside over them, or in which, according to the Pythagoreans, opportunity, justice, marriage, are represented by some number or figure. This is probably the number 216. The explanation given in the text supposes the 2 harmonies to make up the number 8,000. This explanation derives a certain plausibility from the circumstance that 8,000 is the ancient number of the Spartan citizens, Herodotus, and would be what Plato might have called a number which nearly concerns the population of a city. The mysterious disappearance of the Spartan population may possibly have suggested to him the first cause of his decline of states. The lesser or square harmony of 400 might be a symbol of the guardians, the larger or oblong harmony of the people, and the numbers 3, 4, 5 might refer respectively to the 3 orders in the state, or parts of the soul, the 4 virtues, the 5 forms of government. The harmony of the musical scale, which is elsewhere used as a symbol of the harmony of the state, is also indicated. For the numbers 3, 4, 5, which represent the sides of the Pythagorean triangle, also denote the intervals of the scale. The terms used in the statement of the problem may be explained as follows. A perfect number, Greek, as already stated, is one which is equal to the sum of its divisors. Thus, 6, which is the first perfect or cyclical number, equals 1 plus 2 plus 3. The words, Greek, terms or notes, and, Greek, intervals, are applied to music as well as to number and figure. Greek is the base on which the whole calculation depends, or the lowest term from which it can be worked out. The words, Greek, have been variously translated, squared and cubed, Donaldson. Equaling and equaled in power, Weber, by involution and evolution, that is, by raising the power and extracting the root as in the translation. Numbers are called like and unlike, Greek, when the factors or the sides of the planes and cubes which they represent are or are not in the same ratio. For example, 8 and 27 equal 2 cubed and 3 cubed, and conversely. Waxing, Greek, numbers, called also increasing, Greek, are those which are exceeded by the sum of their divisors. For example, 12 and 18 are less than 16 and 21. Waning, Greek, numbers, called also decreasing, Greek, are those which succeed the sum of their divisors. For example, 8 and 27 exceed 7 and 13. The words translated commensurable and agreeable to one another, Greek, seem to be different ways of describing the same relation, with more or less precision. They are equivalent to expressible in terms having the same relation to one another, like the series 8, 12, 18, 27, each of which numbers is in the relation of 1 and 1 half to the preceding. The base or fundamental number, which has 1/3 added to it, 1 1/3, equals 4/3, or a musical fourth. Greek is a proportion of numbers as of musical notes, applied either to the parts or factors of a single number, or to the relation of one number to another. The first harmony is a square number, Greek. The second harmony is an oblong number, Greek. That is, a number representing a figure of which the opposite sides only are equal. Greek equals number squared from or upon diameters. Greek equals rational, that is, omitting fractions. Greek irrational, that is, including fractions. For example, 49 is a square of the rational diameter of a figure the side of which equals 5 to 50, of an irrational diameter of the same. For several of the explanations here given, and for a good deal besides, I am indebted to an excellent article on the Platonic number by Dr. Donaldson, Proceedings of the Philological Society. The conclusions which he draws from these data are summed up by him as follows. Having assumed that the number of the perfect or divine cycle is the number of the world, and the number of the imperfect cycle the number of the state, he proceeds, the period of the world is defined by the perfect number 6, that of the state by the cube of that number, or 216, which is the product of the last pair of terms in the Platonic Tetractus, a series of 7 terms, 1, 2, 3, 4, 9, 8, 27. And if we take this as the basis of our computation, we shall have 2 cube numbers, Greek, viz. 8 and 27, and the mean proportionals between these, viz. 12 and 18, will furnish 3 intervals and 4 terms, and these terms and intervals stand related to one another in the sesqui-altera ratio, that is, each term is to the preceding as 3 over 2. Now, if we remember that the number 216 equals 8 times 27 equals 3 cubed plus 4 cubed plus 5 cubed, and 3 squared plus 4 squared equal 5 squared, we must admit that this number implies the numbers 3, 4, 5, to which musicians attach so much importance. And if we combine the ratio 4 to 3 with the number 5, or multiply the ratios of the sides by the hypotenuse, we shall, by first squaring and then cubing, obtain 2 expressions, which denote the ratio of the 2 last pairs of terms in the Platonic Tetractus, the former multiplied by the square, the latter by the cube of the number 10, the sum of the first 4 digits which constitute the Platonic Tetractus. The 2, Greek, he elsewhere explains as follows. The first, Greek, is Greek. In other words, 4 over 3 times 5, all squared, equals 100 times 2 squared over 3 squared. The second, Greek, a cube of the same root, is described as 100 multiplied, alpha, by the rational diameter of 5 diminished by unity, that is, as shown above, 48. Beta, by 2 incommensurable diameters, that is, the 2 first irrationals, or 2 and 3, and gamma, by the cube of 3, or 27. Thus, we have 48 plus 5 plus 27 times 100 equals 1,000 times 2 cubed. This second harmony is to be the cube of the number of which the former harmony is the square, and therefore must be divided by the cube of 3. In other words, the whole expression will be 1 for the first harmony, 400 over 9, 2 for the second harmony, 8,000 over 27. The reasons which have inclined me to agree with Dr. Donaldson and also with Schleiermacher in supposing that 216 is the Platonic number of births are 1, that it coincides with the description of the number given in the first part of the passage, Greek. 2, that the number 216 with its permutations would have been familiar to a Greek mathematician, though unfamiliar to us. 3, that 216 is the cube of 6, and also the sum of 3 cubed, 4 cubed, 5 cubed, the numbers 3, 4, and 5 representing the Pythagorean triangle, of which the sides, when squared, equal the square of the hypotenuse, 9 plus 16 equals 25. 4. That it is also the period of the Pythagorean metempsychosis. 5. The three ultimate terms or bases, 3, 4, 5, of which 216 is composed, answer to the 3rd, 4th, 5th in the musical scale. 6. That the number 216 is the product of the cubes of 2 and 3, which are the two last terms in the Platonic Tetractus. 7. That the Pythagorean triangle is said by Plutarch, De Isis et Osiris, Proclus, Super Prima Euclid, and Quintilian, De Musica, to be contained in this passage, so that the tradition of the school seems to point in the same direction. 8. That the Pythagorean triangle is called also the figure of marriage, Greek. But, though agreeing with Dr. Donaldson thus far, I see no reason for supposing, as he does, that the first or perfect number is the world, the human or imperfect number the state, nor has he given any proof that the second harmony is a cube, nor do I think that Greek can mean two incommensurables, which he arbitrarily assumes to be 2 and 3, but rather, as the preceding clause implies, Greek, that is, two square numbers based upon irrational diameters of a figure the side of which is 5 equals 50 times 2. The greatest objection to the translation is the sense given to the words, Greek, a base of 3 with a third added to it multiplied by 5. In this somewhat forced manner, Plato introduces once more the numbers of the Pythagorean triangle. But the coincidences in the numbers which follow are in favor of the explanation. The first harmony of 400, as has been already remarked, probably represents the rulers. The second and oblong harmony of 7,600, the people. And here we take leave of the difficulty. The discovery of the riddle would be useless and would throw no light on ancient mathematics. The point of interest is that Plato should have used such a symbol, and that so much of the Pythagorean spirit should have prevailed in him. His general meaning is that divine creation is perfect, and is represented or presided over by a perfect or cyclical number. Human generation is imperfect, and represented or presided over by an imperfect number or series of numbers. The number 5040, which is the number of the citizens in the laws, is expressly based by him on utilitarian grounds, namely, the convenience of the number for division. It is also made up of the first 7 digits multiplied by one another. The contrast of the perfect and imperfect number may have been easily suggested by the corrections of the cycle, which were made first by Meton and secondly by Callippus. The latter is said to have been a pupil of Plato. Of the degree of importance or of exactness to be attributed to the problem, the number of the tyrant in Book 9, 729 equals 365 times 2, and the slight correction of the error in the number 5040 over 12, laws, may furnish a criterion. There is nothing surprising in the circumstance that those who were seeking for order in nature and had found order in number should have imagined one to give law to the other. Plato believes in a power of number far beyond what he could see realized in the world around him, and he knows the great influence which the little matter of 1, 2, 3 exercises upon education. He may even be thought to have a prophetic anticipation of the discoveries of Quetelet and others, that numbers depend upon numbers. For example, in population, the numbers of births, and the respective numbers of children born of either sex, on the respective ages of parents, that is, on other numbers. Book 9. Last of all comes the tyrannical man, about whom we have to inquire, whence is he, and how does he live, in happiness or in misery? There is, however, a previous question of the nature and number of the appetites, which I should like to consider first. Some of them are unlawful, and yet admit of being chastened and weakened in various degrees by the power of reason and law. What appetites do you mean? I mean those which are awake when the reasoning powers are asleep, which get up and walk about naked without any self-respect or shame. And there is no conceivable folly or crime, however cruel or unnatural, of which, in imagination, they may not be guilty. True, he said, very true. But when a man's pulse beats temperately, and he has supped on a feast of reason, and comes to a knowledge of himself before going to rest, and has satisfied his desires just enough to prevent their perturbing his reason, which remains clear and luminous, and when he is free from quarrel and heat, the visions which he has on his bed are least irregular and abnormal. Even in good men there is such an irregular wild beast nature which peers out in sleep. To return, you remember what was said of the Democrat, that he was the son of a miserly father who encouraged the saving desires and repressed the ornamental and expensive ones. Presently the youth got into fine company and began to entertain a dislike to his father's narrow ways, and being a better man than the corruptors of his youth, he came to a mean and led a life not of lawless or slavish passion, but of regular and successive indulgence. Now imagine that the youth has become a father, and has a son who is exposed to the same temptations, and has companions who lead him into every sort of iniquity, and parents and friends who try to keep him right. The counselors of evil find that their only chance of retaining him is to implant in his soul a monster drone, or love, while other desires buzz around him and mystify him with sweet sounds and scents. This monster love takes possession of him and puts an end to every true or modest thought or wish. Love, like drunkenness and madness, is a tyranny, and the tyrannical man, whether made by nature or habit, is just a drinking, lusting, furious sort of animal. And how does such a one live? Nay, that you must tell me. Well, then I fancy that he will live amid revelries and harlotries, and love will be the lord and master of the house. Many desires require much money, and so he spends all that he has and borrows more. And when he has nothing, the young ravens are still in the nest in which they were hatched, crying for food. Love urges them on, and they must be gratified by force or fraud, or if not, they become painful and troublesome. And as the new pleasures succeed the old ones, so will the son take possession of the goods of his parents. If they show signs of refusing, he will defraud and deceive them. And if they openly resist, what then? I can only say that I should not much like to be in their place. But, oh heavens, Adamantus, to think that for some new-fangled or unnecessary love he will give up his old father and mother, best and dearest of friends, or enslave them to the fancies of the hour. Truly a tyrannical son is a blessing to his father and mother. When there is no more to be got out of them, he turns burglar or pickpocket, or robs a temple. Love overmasters the thoughts of his youth, and he becomes in sober reality the monster that he was sometimes in sleep. He waxes strong in all violence and lawlessness, and is ready for any deed of daring that will supply the wants of his rabble-rout. In a well-ordered state there are only a few such, and these in time of war go out and become the mercenaries of a tyrant. But in time of peace they stay at home and do mischief. They are the thieves, footpads, cut-purses, man-stealers of the community. Or if they are able to speak, they turn false witnesses and informers. No small catalogue of crimes, truly, even if the perpetrators are few. Yes, I said, but small and great are relative terms, and no crimes which are committed by them approach those of the tyrant, whom this class, growing strong and numerous, create out of themselves. If the people yield, well and good, but if they resist, then, as before he beat his father and mother, so now he beats his fatherland and motherland, and places his mercenaries over them. Such men in their early days live with flatterers, and they themselves flatter others in order to gain their ends. But they soon discard their followers when they have no longer any need of them. They are always either masters or servants. The joys of friendship are unknown to them, and they are utterly treacherous and unjust, if the nature of justice be at all understood by us. They realize our dream, and he who is the most of a tyrant by nature and leads the life of a tyrant for the longest time will be the worst of them, and being the worst of them will also be the most miserable. Like man, like state, the tyrannical man will answer to tyranny, which is the extreme opposite of the royal state, for one is the best and the other the worst. But which is the happier? Great and terrible as the tyrant may appear enthroned amid his satellites, let us not be afraid to go in and ask. And the answer is that the monarchical is the happiest, and the tyrannical the most miserable of states. And may we not ask the same question about the men themselves, requesting someone to look into them who is able to penetrate the inner nature of man and will not be panic-struck by the vain pomp of tyranny? I will suppose that he is one who has lived with him and has seen him in family life, or perhaps in the hour of trouble and danger. Assuming that we ourselves are the impartial judge for whom we seek, let us begin by comparing the individual and state, and ask first of all whether the state is likely to be free or enslaved. Will there not be a little freedom and a great deal of slavery? And the freedom is of the bad, and the slavery of the good, and this applies to the man as well as to the state, for his soul is full of meanness and slavery, and the better part is enslaved to the worse. He cannot do what he would, and his mind is full of confusion. He is the very reverse of a freeman. The state will be poor and full of misery and sorrow, and the man's soul will also be poor and full of sorrows, and he will be the most miserable of men. No, not the most miserable, for there is yet a more miserable. Who is that? The tyrannical man who has the misfortune also to become a public tyrant. There I suspect that you are right. Say rather, I am sure. Conjecture is out of place in an inquiry of this nature. He is like a wealthy owner of slaves, only he has more of them than any private individual. You will say, the owners of slaves are not generally in any fear of them. But why? Because the whole city is in a league which protects the individual. Suppose, however, that one of these owners and his household is carried off by a god into a wilderness where there are no freemen to help him. Will he not be in an agony of terror? Will he not be compelled to flatter his slaves and to promise them many things sore against his will? And suppose the same God who carried him off were to surround him with neighbors who declare that no man ought to have slaves, and that the owners of them should be punished with death. Still worse and worse, he will be in the midst of his enemies. And is not our tyrant such a captive soul, who is tormented by a swarm of passions which he cannot indulge, living indoors always like a woman, and jealous of those who can go out and see the world? Having so many evils, will not the most miserable of men be still more miserable in a public station? Master of others when he is not master of himself? Like a sick man who is compelled to be an athlete, the meanest of slaves and the most abject of flatterers, wanting all things and never able to satisfy his desires, always in fear and distraction, like the state of which he is the representative. His jealous, hateful, faithless temper grows worse with command. He is more and more faithless, envious, unrighteous. The most wretched of men, a misery to himself and to others. And so let us have a final trial and proclamation. Need we hire a herald, or shall I proclaim the result? The son of Ariston, the best, is of opinion that the best and justest of men is also the happiest, and that this is he who is the most royal master of himself, and that the unjust man is he who is the greatest tyrant of himself and of his state, and I add further, seen or unseen by gods or men. This is our first proof. The second is derived from the three kinds of pleasure, which answer to the three elements of the soul, reason, passion, desire, under which last is comprehended avarice as well as sensual appetite, while passion includes ambition, party feeling, love of reputation. Reason, again, is solely directed to the attainment of truth, and careless of money and reputation. In accordance with the difference of men's natures, one of these three principles is in the ascendant, and they have their several pleasures corresponding to them. Interrogate now the three natures, and each one will be found praising his own pleasures and depreciating those of others. The moneymaker will contrast the vanity of knowledge with the solid advantages of wealth. The ambitious man will despise knowledge which brings no honor, whereas the philosopher will regard only the fruition of truth and will call other pleasures necessary rather than good. Now, how shall we decide between them? Is there any better criterion than experience and knowledge? And which of the three has the truest knowledge and the widest experience? The experience of youth makes the philosopher acquainted with the two kinds of desire, but the avaricious and the ambitious man never taste the pleasures of truth and wisdom. Honor he has equally with them. They are judged of him, but he is not judged of them, for they never attain to the knowledge of true being. And his instrument is reason, whereas their standard is only wealth and honor. And if by reason we are to judge, his good will be the truest. And so we arrive at the result that the pleasure of the rational part of the soul, and a life passed in such pleasure, is the pleasantest. He who has a right to judge, judges thus. Next comes the life of ambition, and in the third place that of money-making. Twice has the just man overthrown the unjust, once more as in an Olympian contest, first offering up a prayer to the Savior Zeus, let him try a fall. A wise man whispers to me that the pleasures of the wise are true and pure. All others are a shadow only. Let us examine this. Is not pleasure opposed to pain, and is there not a mean state which is neither? When a man is sick, nothing is more pleasant to him than health, but this he never found out while he was well. In pain, he desires only to cease from pain. On the other hand, when he is in an ecstasy of pleasure, rest is painful to him. Thus, rest or cessation is both pleasure and pain. But can that which is neither become both? Again, pleasure and pain are motions, and the absence of them is rest. But if so, how can the absence of either of them be the other? Thus we are led to infer that the contradiction is an appearance only, and witchery of the senses. And these are not the only pleasures, for there are others which have no preceding pains. Pure pleasure, then, is not the absence of pain, nor pure pain the absence of pleasure. Although most of the pleasures which reach the mind through the body are reliefs of pain, and have not only their reactions when they depart, but their anticipations before they come, they can be best described in a simile. There is in nature an upper, lower, and middle region, and he who passes from the lower to the middle imagines that he is going up, and is already in the upper world, and if he were taken back again would think, and truly think, that he was descending. All this arises out of his ignorance of the true upper, middle, and lower regions. And a like confusion happens with pleasure and pain, and with many other things. The man who compares gray with black calls gray white, and a man who compares absence of pain with pain calls the absence of pain pleasure. Again, hunger and thirst are inanitions of the body, ignorance and folly of the soul, and food is the satisfaction of the one, knowledge of the other. Now which is the purer satisfaction, that of eating and drinking, or that of knowledge? Consider the matter thus. The satisfaction of that which has more existence is truer than of that which has less. The invariable and immortal has a more real existence than the variable and mortal, and has a corresponding measure of knowledge and truth. The soul, again, has more existence and truth and knowledge than the body, and is therefore more really satisfied and has a more natural pleasure. Those who feast only on earthly food are always going at random up to the middle and down again, but they never pass into the true upper world or have a taste of true pleasure. They are like fatted beasts, full of gluttony and sensuality, and ready to kill one another by reason of their insatiable lust, for they are not filled with true being, and their vessel is leaky. Gorgeous. Their pleasures are mere shadows of pleasure, mixed with pain, colored and intensified by contrast, and therefore intensely desired. And men go fighting about them, as Thesaurus says that the Greeks fought about the shadow of Helen at Troy, because they know not the truth. The same may be said of the passionate element. The desires of the ambitious soul, as well as of the covetous, have an inferior satisfaction. Only when under the guidance of reason do either of the other principles do their own business or attain the pleasure which is natural to them. When not attaining, they compel the other parts of the soul to pursue a shadow of pleasure which is not theirs. And the more distant they are from philosophy and reason, the more distant they will be from law and order, and the more elusive will be their pleasures. The desires of love and tyranny are the farthest from law, and those of the king are nearest to it. There is one genuine pleasure, and two spurious ones. The tyrant goes beyond even the latter. He has run away altogether from law and reason. Nor can the measure of his inferiority be told except in a figure. The tyrant is the third removed from the oligarch, and has therefore not a shadow of his pleasure, but the shadow of a shadow only. The oligarch, again, is thrice removed from the king, and thus we get the formula 3 times 3, which is the number of a surface, representing the shadow which is the tyrant's pleasure. And if you like to cube this number of the beast, you will find that the measure of the difference amounts to 729. The king is 729 times more happy than the tyrant. And this extraordinary number is nearly equal to the number of days and nights in a year. 365 times 2 equals 730, and is therefore concerned with human life. This is the interval between a good and bad man in happiness only. What must be the difference between them in comeliness of life and virtue? Perhaps you may remember someone saying at the beginning of our discussion that the unjust man was profited if he had the reputation of justice. Now that we know the nature of justice and injustice, let us make an image of the soul which will personify his words. First of all, fashion a multitudinous beast, having a ring of heads of all manner of animals, tame and wild, and able to produce and change them at pleasure. Suppose now another form of a lion, and another of a man, the second smaller than the first, the third than the second. Join them together and cover them with a human skin in which they are completely concealed. When this has been done, let us tell the supporter of injustice that he is feeding up the beasts and starving the man. The maintainer of justice, on the other hand, is trying to strengthen the man. He is nourishing the gentle principle within him, and making an alliance with the lion heart in order that he may be able to keep down the many-headed hydra and bring all into unity with each other and with themselves. Thus, in every point of view, whether in relation to pleasure, honor, or advantage, the just man is right and the unjust wrong. But now let us reason with the unjust, who is not intentionally in error. Is not the noble that which subjects the beast to the man, or rather to the god in man? The ignoble, that which subjects the man to the beast? And if so, who would receive gold on condition that he was to degrade the noblest part of himself under the worst? Who would sell his son or daughter into the hands of brutal and evil men for any amount of money? And will he sell his own fairer and diviner part without any compunction to the most godless and foul? Would he not be worse than Eriphyle, who sold her husband's life for a necklace? And intemperance is the letting loose of the multiform monster, and pride and sullenness are the growth and increase of the lion and serpent element, while luxury and effeminacy are caused by a too great relaxation of spirit. Flattery and meanness again arise when the spirited element is subjected to avarice, and the lion is habituated to become a monkey. The real disgrace of handicraft arts is that those who are engaged in them have to flatter instead of mastering their desires. Therefore, we say they should be placed under the control of the better principle in another, because they have none in themselves. Not, as Thrasymachus imagined, to the injury of the subjects, but for their good. And our intention in educating the young is to give them self-control. The law desires to nurse up in them a higher principle, and when they have acquired this, they may go their ways. What, then shall a man profit if he gain the whole world, and become more and more wicked? Or what shall he profit by escaping discovery, if the concealment of evil prevents a cure? If he had been punished, the brute within him would have been silenced, and the gentler element liberated, and he would have united temperance, justice, and wisdom in his soul, a union better far than any combination of bodily gifts. The man of understanding will honor knowledge above all. In the next place, he will keep under his body not only for the sake of health and strength, but in order to attain the most perfect harmony of body and soul. In the acquisition of riches, too, he will aim at order and harmony. He will not desire to heap up wealth without measure, but he will fear that the increase of wealth will disturb the constitution of his own soul. For the same reason, he will only accept such honors as will make him a better man. Any others he will decline. In that case, said he will never be a politician. Yes, but he will in his own city, though probably not in his native country unless by some divine accident. You mean that he will be a citizen of the ideal city which has no place upon earth? But in heaven, I replied, there is a pattern of such a city, and he who wishes may order his life after that image. Whether such a state is or ever will be matters not. He will act according to that pattern and no other. The most noticeable points in the ninth book of the Republic are, 1. The account of pleasure, 2. The number of the interval which divides the king from the tyrant, 3. The pattern which is in heaven. 1. Plato's account of pleasure is remarkable for moderation, and in this respect contrasts with the later Platonists and the views which are attributed to them by Aristotle. He is not, like the Cynics, opposed to all pleasure, but rather desires that the several parts of the soul shall have their natural satisfaction. He even agrees with the Epicureans in describing pleasure as something more than the absence of pain. This is proved by the circumstance that there are pleasures which have no antecedent pains, as he also remarks in the Philebus, such as the pleasures of smell, and also the pleasures of hope and anticipation. In the previous book, he had made the distinction between necessary and unnecessary pleasure, which is repeated by Aristotle, and he now observes that there is a further class of wild beast pleasures, corresponding to Aristotle's Greek. He dwells upon the relative and unreal character of sensual pleasures, and the illusion which arises out of the contrast of pleasure and pain, pointing out the superiority of the pleasures of reason, which are at rest, over the fleeting pleasures of sense and emotion. The preeminence of royal pleasure is shown by the fact that reason is able to form a judgment of the lower pleasures, while the two lower parts of the soul are incapable of judging the pleasures of reason. Thus, in his treatment of pleasure, as in many other subjects, the philosophy of Plato is sawn up into quantities by Aristotle. The analysis which was originally made by him became, in the next generation, the foundation of further technical distinctions. Both in Plato and Aristotle, we note the illusion under which the ancients fell of regarding the transience of pleasure as a proof of its unreality, and of confounding the permanence of the intellectual pleasures with the unchangeableness of the knowledge from which they are derived. Neither do we like to admit that the pleasures of knowledge, though more elevating, are not more lasting than other pleasures, and are almost equally dependent on the accidents of our bodily state. Introduction to Philebus. 2. The number of the interval which separates the king from the tyrant and royal from tyrannical pleasures is 729, the cube of 9, which Plato characteristically designates as a number concerned with human life because nearly equivalent to the number of days and nights in the year. He is desirous of proclaiming that the interval between them is immeasurable, and invents a formula to give expression